Yeah, yeah. And no one like me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Congratulations, you made it. Welcome to the Crusader.
My very special guest today is Sue Bradford. She's a, well, she was a Green MP and an activist beforehand. And I'd like to bring her on today to talk about benefit cutting, because this is happening more recently in New Zealand as it happens in the United States and many other countries around the world. It seems to be happening simultaneously. And I wanted to learn a bit more about the New Zealand perspective because, quite frankly, admittedly, I don't understand the issue at present. Sue, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. Great to talk to you today.
Well, you know, it's fabulous to have somebody of such social stigma on the show. Now, the benefits are being cut. How big are the cuts? Where's it coming from? Who's responsible?
It's not quite as clear as that. What's happened earlier this year, the government brought in some new legislation around benefits, which is doing things like work testing sole parents once the youngest child turns six, which means that they're basically harassing solo mums back out to work, very much on the American model. And the second thing is that they're doing a lot more to work test and harass people who are on the sickness benefit and starting to try and push people over from what we call here the invalid benefit onto the sickness benefit. And the sickness benefit is paid at a much lower rate than the invalid's benefit, which means if people are pushed like that, they're getting less money, and benefits in this country are already very low. But what we're people like myself who are activists in the welfare and poverty area, what we're even more worried about is what John Key, our Prime Minister, and Paula Bennett might do next year. We've had something called the Welfare Working Group established by the government, and they're going to make a whole lot of recommendations in February next year. And so far from what we've seen, we're very concerned about the directions that the government might be taking. And that's why I've been part of this thing called the Alternative Welfare Working Group, which received a whole lot of submissions and went around the country talking to people and has just launched a major report last week, trying to put up other ideas about how our welfare system could be reformed that don't involve harming people.
And what kind of alternatives are you suggesting? I mean, specifically, the government, they want to take people off of the benefit after they've been on it for, say, a year, or rather review them after a year, whereas previously that wouldn't have to happen. How would that affect people that are currently on the benefit?
Well, yes, that's one of the other reforms that's already happened, is if that you're registered on the unemployment benefit, you automatically are taken off after 1 year and have to reapply. And some people get very frightened and freaked out when that happens and just fall off the benefit and end up with no income. So that's the biggest danger, especially at a time when unemployment is quite high and I think will be rising in the year ahead. But some of the worst things that we fear the government will do next year include doing a lot more to push most beneficiaries, sole parents, sickness, invalids, everybody, into what is called the work-tested category. So in other words, they'll be trying to apply the sort of work-testing regime that's currently imposed on unemployed beneficiaries onto most beneficiaries, leaving just a few people who are in a very bad situation on the invalid's benefit at a higher rate. And that's really the worst of what we see is happening. They have put up a whole lot of options, the government working group, including things like, for example, work testing sole parents when the youngest child is three or when the youngest child is one. Again, very much like the Wisconsin model that some people listening to this are probably very familiar with. They've even talked about if a woman's on the benefit and she has any further children while on the benefit, that they won't pay any more allowances for those children and that they'll work test her on the first child only. And one of our biggest worries is that this whole thrust is so anti-women and children that it will push more and more women and children into even deeper poverty than they're in already.
And which will likely increase the rates of crime.
That's right. And recently, I was in Wellington last week, and this is just a rumour. Basically, I can't go direct to source on it because of confidentiality, but in a private meeting with church leaders, the Prime Minister, John Key, said to the church leaders, quote, "If we cancel welfare for 330,000 people currently on welfare, how many would starve to death? Bugger all." Now, I don't think that the Prime Minister is going to cut welfare to 330,000 people because he knows that the electorate won't stand for it. But what scares me about that quote is that it's indicative of Mr. Keat's thinking on welfare. That is, in this country, if you just leave people without any income, they're going to survive somehow. Which brings me back to what you just said, Vinny, that if we have that situation, we'll go very rapidly down the route for what's already happening in big parts of America, where we would have much increased homelessness, begging. We have begging in the streets already, but a lot more people begging in the streets. And, of course, our crime rate would go through the roof, and we already have one of the most imprisoned populations, nothing like the States, but pretty bad for a small country like ours. No thought that actually keeping people in prison is far more expensive than paying an unemployment or a sole parents benefit. And so I am very frightened that we may be heading down what pertains in much of the United States very quickly.
I'm concerned about, you understand the Hegelian dialectic of creating a problem and then as people react to the problem, propose the solution. My expectation is that the government will do this in an effort to heighten public need, so to speak, for a more stronger and brutal police regime. Because if you look at legislation such as the Search and Surveillance Bill, this new SIS bill, I believe that our country is becoming more and more a police state in a totalitarian tiptoeing fashion, so that people will not understand why there's men with black uniforms on the streets bashing up protesters. Because a whole bunch of different things caused by the government would have been responsible for such a problem in the first place. Now, considering that, where exactly is the government trying to justify doing these types of things?
The justification for the welfare reforms is that, that they're saying, what the government is saying is basically that we've got a crisis, that this country is in deficit, and that we can't afford to keep paying welfare at the rates that we currently are. Now, benefit levels in this country are already very, very low, much lower than national superannuation. Wages are low as well, but benefits are even lower than wages. And what the government's welfare working group is doing is exactly what you're talking about. They're manufacturing a crisis that doesn't exist. They're trying to pretend that welfare costs are going to balloon out of hand over the next 40 years, and that because of the threat of those ballooning costs, they're going to have to make all these changes, which many of us are so scared of. It's a very classic capitalist tactic, as Naomi Klein has talked about, the manufactured crisis, and that's exactly what they're doing. When you look at the government's own Treasury budget, and Treasury is not a left-wing bell, they're very right-wing themselves, but Treasury's own budget last year showed that the ballooning cost of this country will not be in working-age welfare payments, but in superannuation paid to our older people. It will be in health costs, a lot of that because of the ageing population, and also in the cost of servicing our financial debt. Those are the sort of costs that are going to go out of hand, nothing to do with working-age welfare. And in none of this does the government pay any attention to the fact that the main reason welfare numbers in this country are going up at the moment is because of unemployment. Simple fact, if you have more people out of work, you have more people on the dole. And they never talk about that.
Well, they wouldn't really, because they'd have to talk about something real then. And in my experience, the two main parties, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, don't approach real issues, because it means that they would have to approach real solutions. And if solutions are, in fact, implemented, it means that they would lose their justification to pass whatever legislation they like. That's my opinion, of course. But on top of this, what's going on with benefits in terms of costing, because how much does a benefit the benefit payments cost annually, as opposed to the government borrowing $250 million a week, indebting our country to international banks? And in fact, no, they've just upped that to $300 million a week.
That's right. Well, in terms of playing with figures, they say that it costs about $6 billion a year for welfare here. And when they did this manufactured crisis thing, they said that by 2050, welfare in this country would grow to $50 billion a year. But these figures are totally out of hand because they made that calculation on an insurance risk basis, which says that we will count the cost of every beneficiary, every person that's got a benefit now, staying on a benefit for the rest of their lives. Now, most people on benefits actually go off them reasonably quickly, especially when jobs come back. Most people on benefits desperately do not want to be on them, and they're using these totally artificial figures to claim that there's a crisis. In terms of how you spend money, that is up to a government. This government has chosen, at the same time as it's saying we've got to cut welfare costs because we can't afford it. For example, in the last budget in May this year, they gave tax cuts to the very rich at a much higher rate than any tax cuts to the poor. And those tax cuts to the rich were paid for, and the Prime Minister made no bones about it, paid for out of borrowing. So they're prioritising tax cuts for the rich over the needs of low-income families and their children. They've also spent over $1.5 billion of government money towards the bailout of South Canterbury Finance. And they paid $100 million to keep The Hobbit, you know, to an American film company, to keep The Hobbit production here, and so on and so on. So it's all a matter of where your priorities lie. And this government is choosing to bail out investors and finance companies rather than support low-income people and their families. And these are the sort of choices that are being made daily in America and Europe and around the world. But that doesn't mean that some of us accept those choices. Some of us are fighting back.
Well, anybody who would actually look at the reality, you know, this is funny, Sue, because every time that I listen to John Key, this one phrase comes up that he uses repeatedly. Well, the reality is, and I'm just going to borrow a little leaf out of his book. The reality is that if we followed America and followed the EU, we would have crises like they've got in America and like they've got in the EU. I mean, it's pretty stark obvious. Now, you'd figure that an international bankster like John Key, who was on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank for 2 years as the head of derivatives under Merrill Lynch, derivatives being one of the prime causes of the 2008 global credit crisis, you'd figure he'd understand, being a man who's worth $50 million, that borrowing and borrowing and borrowing doesn't get you out of debt and indeed just puts you into the territory of receivership. What does he think, that New Zealand's going to get bailed out by the international banks once we collapse? I don't think so.
No, we're living in a little bubble here in New Zealand, protected mainly by the umbrella of Australia, whose economy's been doing very well because of its basically, I think, because of its natural resources. But that little bubble's going to burst sometime. And at the same time as we've got that, as you say, we've got a Prime Minister who's basically a gambler, you know, someone who made his fortune of $50 million gambling on derivatives and other financial instruments. And I think he brings that gambling perspective to our money and our lives. I don't know what his values base is. And that scares me. In the 90s, we had a right-wing national government as well, but it was led by Jim Bolger, who was a Catholic. And I can really see a difference between Jim Bolger, who actually did have some values, and who I think in later years, under the influence of church leadership, actually decided that perhaps the really right-wing direction they were taking was going too far and sacked Ruth Richardson as finance minister, for example. Now, Jim Bolger, who I demonstrated against many times, at least he had that value space. What really scares me with John Key is I don't think he has that. He doesn't have the empathy. He's a very jovial, friendly, cheery chap, and people love him because of his smile. But what concerns me is what lies behind that smile.
It's the key deception. I would think that, and I've interviewed John Key once, and I've not bothered to try again, simply because of the fact that he is, as far as I'm concerned, an incredible actor. And coming from an acting background, and my cousin being Lucy Lawless, I know what good acting is, and that's precisely what he does. He is smiling. He manages to dodge questions with a skill that I've not seen before. And like, for example, in Parliament, when Keith Locke questioned him over why the new SIS bill was being conducted in secret, instead of answering the question, he said, oh, Helen Clark conducted stuff in secret previously, right? So he kind of passes the buck. Now, in terms of leadership, in my opinion, a good leader is not the person who passes the buck. A good leader is the person for whom the buck stops with. He's not doing that. But the brain dead, sorry, New Zealand audience, the brain dead Kiwi public who vote for this person and love this two-party false left-right puppet show are still convinced by this, which is true testament to his acting prowess.
Mm, you're right. You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. He's very good. He's very good at acting, and he's very, very personable, however you say it. Yeah, I mean, people do warm to him. It's a great attribute in a politician, but very scary with this particular politician because he is clever and he is a gambler. And he knows whose side he's on. There's still this idea that he's really not so bad, that he's, you know, people like Don Brash are used as stalking horses to say, well, John Key's nowhere near as bad as Don Brash. But in fact, I don't believe his politics are any different. It's just he keeps them better hidden.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Their politics don't change. It's just their tactics of delivering those politics changes, right? So what kind, if we were to do a credible analysis of how the National Party is running this government, my analysis would basically stem from production of crises. Now, if that is the case, what's the end game here? What are they planning to do to this country? Because we see things, the talk of privatization. We see the increase of taxes. We see the erosion of civil liberties. We see the cutting of social services. My very special guest today, yeah, the older government seems to be going a tad rogue lately. And I'm just kind of really concerned about all this business, you know, if that's what you can call it, because that's what governments are being run like these days. They're not being run like a supposed to be a government, which is to protect people's rights, are they? Well, it's been run like a business.
Well, yeah, it's not even a business. I mean, too many people say it's about money. Hey, it's a lot more than that.
You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And we'll be right back after the break at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Divided we fall, unity, please don't desert me. Are we headed for despotism? Because that's exactly what if the key fits, so to speak.
I mean, that's the big worry. I'm just aware that I'm a little older than you, and I've been through generations of people making the same sort of predictions and having the same fears about a move to totalitarianism. But I think you are still, despite having seen waves of that, and it doesn't happen, thank goodness. But we do need to be aware of the possibility. And one of my biggest fears in terms of us not having a strong Labor Party here. Is that people will move to the right in the absence of anything on the left to whom they can turn. Because we are living in very dangerous times for all the reasons you've just said. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I'm very concerned this government might sign up to, you know, is just one example of that, of allowing America and American corporations that have enormous control over our economic lives, and that would be, that in itself would be dreadful. But as you say, the threat with all the sector surveillance and SIS legislation that they're looking at for next year is the threat to civil liberties alongside the move to privatisation is very scary. And I guess what concerns me a lot at the moment is that Key continues his mantra that we're not going to do all these things in the first term, but if they get voted back in at our general election next year...
Oh, and they will.
On every poll, the indication is that they will. The real threat then is that they will start to do a much faster, worse reform agenda than what they're already talking about, and that becomes very frightening indeed.
In terms of resisting them, though, what can people do? I mean, you're an experienced activist. I mean, have you had any successes in resisting as an activist rather than as an MP?
Apart from 10 years as a Member of Parliament, I've spent most of my life as a street activist and community activist from the time I was really young. Looking back over it, I've been part of waves of activism that have in the end succeeded. For example, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the Springbok tour, the anti-nuclear, you know, trying to get nuclear warships out of our harbours. A lot of those things did work in the end. We, of course, withdrew from the Vietnam War, and people that supported it went on later to say, no, we shouldn't have been part of it. Those of us who protested against ties with apartheid South Africa later on, even right-wing government was saying that we did the right thing. Of course, our government voted to not allow US nuclear warships in our harbours. So in that sense, a lot of protest movements I've been part of have in the end succeeded. The ones that haven't in the end succeeded have been the economic ones, because from 1983 onwards, my main work has been in the unemployment, welfare and poverty area. And while we carried out many, many protests through the 80s and 90s, you can't exactly say we won anything. Things are only getting worse. But at the same time, it's absolutely critical that as many of us as possible do keep engaging in organised action to expose what's going on in the welfare, poverty and unemployment area, to fight for people's well-being and living, fight against what the government's doing, and also put up constructive alternatives, because I think it's really important always to do more than just protest. It's really important to put forward courageous and far-sighted alternatives what is happening, because if you just protest and get away, people will disrespect you. And what this is about is, for me, is trying to create a new and better society, which is a lot fairer and more humane. And I've spent my life trying to do that. And there are a lot of New Zealanders, just as there are many, many Americans, working for that same goal. And at the same time, of course, being aware of what's happening with the physical environment around us, and of the absolutely necessary links between things like resource depletion and the interconnection with that, with what's happening for ordinary people in poverty.
Now, specifically back on the benefits, I mean, what the government is doing, what would you propose instead?
Our report, for those in New Zealand, or actually even overseas if you're interested, our two reports from the Alternative Welfare Working Group are available online at, if you just go to Welfare Justice in New Zealand, you'd be able to pick up full copies of those reports. In the main report that we issued last week, we actually have a whole chapter that looks at alternatives and solutions. But the big solution is that a whole lot of things are interconnected. Health, education and income are absolutely imperative in terms of the well-being of children and families, that you can't just look at welfare in isolation from work, from housing, from education and so on. You know, children only get a good start in life if they're in good health, if they have access to early childhood education and schooling, if their parents are earning enough money to live on. And you can't just separate welfare out from all of that. So that's the key, you know, the first thing. The second thing I'd say is that what sort of welfare system you have depends on what values base you have as a society. And we actually believe that New Zealand is a lot more humane and fair and compassionate than what our current government would make out, that people in this country don't want to keep going down the track towards the worst of what's going on in the US or the UK at the moment. We don't want a society that's more and more divided, where the gap between the rich and poor keeps growing. And if you start from that values base, then there's a whole lot of other things that can happen. For example, saying that actually getting unemployed people into work, real work at a decent wage, should be the priority of the economic and welfare system, not leaving people to languish on benefits that are too low to live on. This government has no commitment to job creation or support for work, apart from a very tiny program in building a cycleway, which is just pitiful. I mean, it's great they're doing it, but it's tiny in comparison to the number of jobs that need to be created. So getting people into work is a priority. Lifting welfare levels to amounts that people can live on. Our welfare payments are very, very low, if you can get them at all. And often what happens to beneficiaries is that they just end up further and further in debt, both for the government itself and private lenders, in a bid to survive. The problems of substandard housing and homelessness are going up all the time here, and that is in part due to the fact that our welfare pays so little and that the government squashed the whole state housing building program. And then there's a whole lot of reforms that are needed around social welfare legislation itself, and I don't know what extent your listeners would be interested in that.
Well, I've written a little couple of notes here about what National's done so far in terms of cutting funding, and so far they have cut funding to the adult night classes, including hobby classes like belly dancing and painting, numeracy and literacy. They've cut funding to the Enviro Schools Foundation of 670 schools, Education for Sustainability Advisory Services, the Mātauranga Taiao, or Education for Sustainability Support for Kura Kaupapa Māori, the Householder Sustainability Program, the Public Place Recycling Program, the Government 3 Program, which is coordinated by the Ministry of the Environment to deliver leadership and sustainability practices by government agencies, the Sustainability Business Network. They've put ACC levy hikes up. They've cut funding to road education funding, to Ngā Kā Whai Kāwhanama Marama I Ngāturi, the Māori National Law Centre. They've also cut funding to walking and cycling funding, tertiary education funding, and also $700 million from the Fast Forward Fund for Agricultural Research. They've forced the Super City legislation. They're putting in the Search and Surveillance Bill. They're trying to open up the national parks for mining. They're increasing taxes on tobacco, outlawing cell phone use while driving, which is basically going to be like another unapportioned tax that the police can really get off people, and also they've cut funding to DOC, and now they're dropping 1080 in Fiordland. You know, it's a laundry list, and I haven't got all the, I don't have all of the legislation that they've passed here, right? I've got like maybe a fifth of it.
Yes, you could go on. I mean, privatising our prison services is one of them. Privatising prisons on the American model is one of the worst things they're doing. Prioritising building more motorways over public transport and the need to move our transport system to a much more environmentally sustainable and affordable one. There's so many things. I mean, that's a good list, but it's actually a lot longer.
And the list is entitled "What National's Done So Far," you know, and it's not been updated, you know.
Just in the area I work in, but coming back to the first part of your list, one of the worst things that I've seen, with the Alternative Welfare Working Group, we actually had a lot of meetings with beneficiaries and community groups around New Zealand over the last couple of months, and one of the things that really affected me the most was hearing from people that just feel totally locked out of education because of the education cuts, not only to adult education and night school, but also to access to tertiary education now. So people on a benefit, on say a solo mum with children, who's very keen to go to university to get an education so that she can get off the benefit and get a decent job doing something she wants to do, like being a nurse or a teacher, for example. But she can't now get access to tertiary education, so nor can she get access to a decent job. So people are being locked out of both education and work. And a lot of people are really feeling that, and it really hits them hard because they've got the government berating them for being on a benefit and saying they're not doing enough to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But when they come to actually try and get an education, they're locked out. The same at another level, like one of the things we heard that were from people who are migrants to this country, like most other countries, we have a lot of migrants now, people who come here to make a better life for themselves. Some of them come here with money and highly professional people, and they can do okay. But there's a lot of other people who aren't doing so well. And the cuts to night school classes and continuing adult education have really impacted them. At the same time as they too are being told to get out and get a job. But if they don't have good language skills, if there's other skills about adapting to our country that are really tough for them, they're not getting access to the same kind of help they used to. So it's like the government's locking people out and knocking them down at the same time as abusing them. And it's pretty nasty stuff.
They don't want people to be capable of critical thinking because that would threaten what they're doing, you know. And I'd like to thank you very much, Sue, for coming on the show today. Do you have a website or anything that the listeners might be able to catch up with your work on?
I'm on Facebook and Twitter at this point. So anyone can feel free to follow me on Twitter or Facebook. And if you really want to get in touch with me, message me on Facebook and I'll give you my email address. I'm also part of a group called Auckland Action Against Poverty, which we've just set up. Anyone listening to this that would like to get involved, again, contact me. We hope to have a web page up and running shortly, but we haven't quite got there yet.
All right. Thank you very much, Sue, for coming on the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Thank you for having me.
Are we headed for despotism? Now, I apologise, ladies and gentlemen, for the quality of that particular recording. We have a fabulous monopolistic country who has decided that it's a great idea for one enormous telecommunications company to have basic power over the airwaves and whatnot. And Sue was joining us via a telecom stick, which apparently doesn't provide that much connection. So you will have to forgive me. But I thought that the interview was quite amicable. And I know that Will has quite a bit to say about this being the rampant right winger that he is.
I don't have much to say, you know. She's probably trying to save power of the telecom stick, you know, to aid climate change. But I'm sorry, Sue. Now, look, I agree. I'm glad there's some resistance and some spirit of resistance in a lot of people. I'm glad that a lot of the commies that get out on the street aren't completely fluoridated to apathy. But I'm not glad that they can't analyze what they're supposedly against. You're against money, you're against the United States? Okay, here we go. Why don't we break it down physically for you? Why don't you look at a US $1 bill that FDR, a 32nd degree Freemason, had designed back in, 34, I believe, with on the left-hand side, a great pyramid with the Roman numerals, 1776, incidentally, not just the Declaration of Independence was signed in that year, but almost simultaneously on the 1st of May, the Bavarian Illuminati was founded. And there you go. There's the Illuminati's uncapped pyramid symbol on the left-hand side, designating the left-hand path of occult magic. See, these people don't know anything like that. They just think the dollar bill's random. Hey, you can think life's random. You can think everything come together by chance and time, but you can't possibly tell me that the designs on the US dollar bill are completely random, happened via an explosion in the printing press. The Great Seal of the United States, with the eagle holding an olive branch with 13 leaves and 13 berries, and in its other talon holding 13 arrows, and it's got 13 tail feathers, and it has 13 stars or pentagrams above it, making up a Star of David. I mean, why don't you look into the design of things and find out who runs the system?
Indeed he do. Speaking of running the system, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and Rush FM in Hamilton. We'll be right back.
Your power, let love come shining through your eyes. We can be, we
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Now, Will, we were talking over the break about how you don't agree with welfare because the ultimate, well, the ultimate tug in there is that if you get people on welfare, well, it just gives the central bankers an extra hook in the economy. They just loan more money to the government, and then it's more in debt, and,
it's a hard one because if I say I'm against welfare, people are like, well, what do you mean? But I'm dependent on that and everything else. And it's like, yeah, I know what it's like to be poor too. You bet. But the problem is Band-Aid solutions aren't the solution. You just dig yourself into more trouble and the bankers laugh at us. We need a fundamental revolution, but not the final revolution that the occult empire want. Here's the problem. Too many people are at ground level trying to work out the ultimate problems from the ground. Trying to think of an analogy here, but you can't say there's a giant weed and it's coming up alongside a nice tree, and this giant weed is 6 foot up and you can see some of the nasty thorns coming off it, and you're just trying to pick thorns off. I'm saying you've got to go to the bottom, you've got to go to the roots, and you've got to pull that weed out by the roots. And people are saying, well, it doesn't have any roots. I just see spikes and leaves and all these flowers coming off it, and I don't like that flower, but I like this one. No, I don't like the National Party, but I like the Labour one. And they're saying there's this giant tree, there's this giant society, there's this establishment, but it doesn't have any roots. And I'm saying, look, there's roots. It's the OTO, it's the Golden Dawn, it's the Bavarian Illuminati, it's the Masons, it's the Catholics, it's all of them. at the pinnacle, not the average Mason or the average Catholic. And they just say, no, conspiracy theory, tree doesn't have roots. The problem is a lot of the left are trying to work out what ultimately runs a system from the tiny little things that they observe affecting them. John Key wants to take my benefit. He's right wing. Left wing must be good. That isn't logic. The more that they, just like having protracted wars in the Middle East, the more that they can get governments to spend on health, on education, making us all sick, making us all stupid, the more that they can indoctrinate a society to be dependent on government, the more the central banks get to loan out to our respective governments, the more they indebt us all. That's why we're in over $800 billion worth of debt officially. It's actually a lot more than that. This is a fundamental problem. The answer is dependence from government, reducing government. And yeah, that's a right-wing thing, but hey, if we get away from those terms and the propagandist connotations that have been implanted in our minds, we start to see, that's how our ancestors lived, independent. Sure, there are wars. There's always going to be wars and fights. People disagree. People disagree with me right now, most people probably. But it's about getting your own food, your own water supply. Stop being lazy. Most people think being lazy is not going out to work for the corporations. No, that's stupid. That's tyranny. That's economic slavery.
Yeah, no. And that's the thing. It's almost the end of independence. This is the era that we're going into now, is that everybody's going to be dependent in one form or another. People have got either one source of income, whether that be from the government or from their prospective employers, and all you got to do is just take that away from them, and they're completely effed. There's nothing they can do. They're absolutely, so totally 100% screwed.
Too many people are pragmatic, i.e. they try and work out society and the flaws in society from the practical consequences. So no job, bad. Government wants to take job, bad. But instead of thinking of the fundamental consequences, that's why people have a go at fundamentalists of any nature in society. But there are fundamentals. If you don't have fundamentals underpinning your worldview, then what do you have? Relativism. And if you have relativism, then the people running society can always change the parameters, can always set the agenda, and they can turn things 180 degrees on you, over a few generations, but that's exactly what they've done.
All the kids have been indoctrinated, and I've always said that our generation, well, our generation's problem is, the biggest problem is that we read between the lines so much we miss the lines themselves, and we don't react when these lines are crossed anymore. When somebody comes out and says that, bailing out huge amounts of banks and getting into enormous amounts of debt is right wing, I just got to laugh, because that is not what right wing is about at all. In fact, is there even a distinct left or right anymore? Or have they're exactly the same now, aren't they?
Even if John Key understands libertarianism or conservatism, he sure as hell doesn't practice it, because he can't, because he is a pawn for the international bankers. And then people want to say, who are they? Look, I'll leave that to you. But he is a pawn. Helen Clark is a pawn, still, in the UN, most definitely. These people are pawns, sadly. They don't actually represent the power. They don't have any real power. They have some symbols, some icons, some anecdotal, hand-me-downs from power. But they don't have any real power.
They're like police officers. They're like police officers wearing a uniform, and that uniform gives them the power. You take away that uniform, the visard disappears, and you realize that they are just a scared, pathetic little rat.
But people think we're making this up. Mayor Rothschild said all this. He said, I care not who's in control of a population. Let me issue their currency, and I care not of their political persuasion. They don't care, but they love socialism. They like, because it gives them the power to make everything equal and fair, and that's a sales pitch, and they get you all addicted to government, and so they can grow their big empire. They can grow their police state. They can grow their militaries. See, how else could they do it?
And what I find ironic is that if you have a look at any big socialist takeover, any big right-wing takeover, they all end up in tyranny. So what the heck is the fundamental difference? There isn't one. Because if you are in power, you're there because they want you to be there. Because they want you to convince the public of something that isn't true, so that they can take control of you, your country, and your children forever. That's the game here. Total, full-spectrum dominance.
And it has to be said, Vinny, the end game is something very simple. The end game of what we want is freedom, something called freedom. Freedom means smashing through a lot of these baloney laws and intellectually rebelling.
Indeed. We'll be back tomorrow, folks.